Lecture 20, Book 9, The Superiority of Justice.
We've reached Book 9 of Plato's Republic. We're getting close to the finish line. Socrates has finished the entire exercise that he promised to complete. He has constructed what he claims is a perfectly just city, and he has also analyzed the various forms of injustice. He is now prepared in a final way to address the original question posed to him by Glaucon. Why prefer a life of justice to a life of injustice? Why not, if we could get away with it, lead a life in which we committed unjust acts and simply attempted to maximize our own self-interest, even if it meant trampling over the interests of others? In short, Socrates is finally prepared to answer once and for all the challenge posed by Thrasymachus in Book 1. We've seen the real answer to the question already. It was contained in the analysis of the tyrant. The tyrant is the maximally unjust human being. And the tyrant, you recall, was described as being a slave. He seems to be on top of the world. He seems to be the political leader of his own country. In fact, he's no more than a slave. He is a slave to his passions. Socrates elaborates this argument in several ways in Book 9, and that's what we'll discuss in this lecture. To do this, he returns to a subject he broached in Lecture 4. This is often referred to as Plato's tripartite psychology. This is the psychological scheme in which the human psyche, often translated as soul, is said to have three parts: reason, spirit, and desire. Socrates returns to this tripartite scheme in Book 9, but in a very interesting way, he subtly but significantly reformulates the three parts. Instead of being reason, spirit, and desire, we find at 581c these three parts. There is the wisdom-loving, the victory-loving, and the gain-loving, clearly corresponding to reason, spirit, and desire, but significantly reformulated because now each of the parts is said to be in love with an object, whether the object is wisdom, victory, or gain. This, I hope, substantiates one of the claims I've made a few times in our course, and that is that for Plato, the very essence of the human psyche, the human soul, is eros, is love. Because now we see that even these seemingly distinct parts of the soul are unified by the fact that each one of them is described as a form of love. In this sense, the soul is really nothing but love. What differentiates one soul from another is what it loves. The oligarch, for example, loves gain, the timocrat loves honor, and the philosopher loves wisdom. Socrates then turns to a new issue. It's not really new. It's a new perspective on the old question, why prefer justice over injustice? And he argues that, in fact, the just person has a life that's vastly more pleasurable than anyone else. If you recall a comment I made much earlier in our course, I was describing the position of hedonism. Hedonism is that position which equates pleasure and the good. For the hedonist, if something is pleasurable, it's good, period, end of story. Socrates rejects hedonism, and he rejects it by means of the following argument. He insists that there are good pleasures and bad pleasures. And once that distinction is made, as we've discussed, there is a standard higher than pleasure that's invoked in order to measure pleasures. So pleasure is not the good. Good pleasure is good. What Socrates is arguing in this section of the Republic is that justice, in fact, philosophy, because we know that the just ruler is the philosopher, gives us the highest, the best form of pleasure. So what I would like to do next is review three of the arguments that Socrates gives on behalf of this thesis. I warn you in advance that you may not be entirely satisfied by these arguments. If that's the case, I would urge you to be patient with Plato because, in fact, I suspect that these arguments are not satisfying and that Plato understands that they're not satisfying. He has something else in mind, as he usually does. He has a little trick up his sleeve. The first argument, the argument on behalf of the idea that philosophy actually gives us the best form of pleasure. The argument here is that the philosopher is the best judge of pleasure. The philosopher is the best critic. Now, why is that? Because the philosopher has tasted every kind of pleasure. The philosopher knows what it is to feel pleasure from gain. The philosopher knows what it is to feel pleasure from honor. The competitors, however, have not tasted the pleasure of wisdom. And therefore, they are in an inferior position to make a judgment about what is the best pleasure. It follows, again, that if the philosopher is the best judge, then the pleasure that the philosopher chooses must be the best pleasure. And of course, we know what pleasure that would be. It's the pleasure of philosophy. Socrates believes he's won his point. I would urge you on your own to review the steps of this argument and you try to figure out for yourself if you think it holds water. As I suggested, it may very well not. Second argument. The pleasure that arises from the love of wisdom, unlike other pleasures, does not give rise to its opposite, pain. It is a pure pleasure. The argument for this position is given at 584b. What does Socrates have in mind? Well, the easiest contrast to make is the hangover. We have a wonderful night of eating and drinking and drinking and drinking. A lot of pleasure, yes, but we pay a big price the next day. Socrates suggests that, in fact, all physical pleasures are like this, even if they're not as overtly connected to pain as the hangover. They are nonetheless caught up in this same transitioning from pleasure to pain, from pain to pleasure. Philosophy, by contrast, he argues, is a pure pleasure. There is no pain that follows the pleasures that we gain from the study of philosophy. Again, perhaps not the most satisfying argument, but certainly interesting. The third argument is very much related to the second, and this I'm referring to is found at 584c. The object of philosophy, the goal of philosophical inquiry, is being. That's a term we've used several times, especially in conjunction with the famous Platonic forms and the idea of the good. The salient feature of being is that it's permanent, it's stable, changeless, eternal, perfect in every way. The key word here is stable. If the philosopher aims to articulate and understand being itself, if the philosopher aims, for example, to move up the divided line, start at the bottom in the realm of images, move all the way up to the top, the idea of the good, such a person, says Socrates here in Book 9, is going to engage a kind of pleasure that's very stable. The pleasure one feels from studying being, Socrates says, is as stable as the object itself, namely being. Now, this may not be very clear, so let me illustrate it again by means of a contrast. Let's go back to our old friend, the oligarch. The oligarch loves profit, gain, money. What do we know about people who love money? And I'll speak anachronistically here. Someone who loves money might invest very heavily in the stock market. And the stock market goes way up. And such a person is very happy, feels a lot of pleasure. But anybody who has invested in the market will know that what goes up must come down. So the person who's made a killing in the stock market and feels pleasure doesn't find that pleasure lasting very long. Either the stock market will crash, and then this person will feel a lot of pain, or even if it doesn't crash, this person will feel what? Anxiety, stress. If you have money, you worry about money. Money, in this case, is an example of a very unstable object. The stock market is the best example of that. Being, by contrast, doesn't go up and down. There are no fluctuations in being. Being is not subject to market forces. Therefore, the pleasure gained by the study of being is a very enduring, stable pleasure. Another way to put this is, no one can take being away. If I'm a student of being, I don't have to fear that somebody's going to steal it from me. If I have a lot of money, I might very well worry that somebody will steal it from me. If I'm engaged in pleasures of the body, I might very well worry that when I get old, I won't be able to experience these pleasures. If I'm a lover of the body, I will probably, above all else, fear death, because death would mean the termination of my pleasures. Again, by contrast, the lover of philosophy, the lover of being, has no such anxiety to plague him. The more you read Plato's dialogues, not just the Republic, the more you'll feel this sense of pleasure in the character. Socrates never seems to get upset. He's famous for only laughing 3 times. We never see him cry. He doesn't seem to experience any of the stress, anxiety that we, and of course ancient Athenians, were so familiar with. He seems to lead a life of constant, stable pleasure. Again, when I speak of Socrates, I refer only to the character appearing in Plato's dialogues. Did the real Socrates live this way? Who knows? We can't know. But as a character created by Plato, inspired by a historical figure, but no doubt filled with Plato's imagination, the character clearly is meant to express just this idea, that a lover of wisdom doesn't suffer the ups and downs, the hangovers, the stresses that the lover of gain or the lover of honor will regularly experience. One last word about the lover of honor. It's a very important point. We might think of a lover of honor also as a lover of fame, loves recognition. Well, such a person might get great pleasure from fame and recognition, but the public is very fickle. And so therefore, such a person will once again be in a state of stress. And therefore, the pleasure gained by fame is fleeting and unstable. The contrast with philosophy can be made again. These arguments about pleasure are designed to remind us of the essential task Socrates believes he has now completed, to demonstrate to Glaucon that the life of philosophy is in every which way superior to any other life. In particular, it's most superior to the life of the tyrant, the person who is able, apparently, to maximize his own self-interest. At this point, and the point I'm referring to in the text is found at 587e, Socrates makes a joke. Not a joke that will cause you to laugh out loud, but a subtle philosophical joke. Socrates says the philosopher king, the philosopher ruler, the philosopher queen, the thoroughly just philosophical soul that we've explored for all these many pages, lives 729 times more pleasantly than the tyrant. So the best life is precisely 729 times better than the worst life. This is a joke because who could possibly demonstrate with such mathematical precision that one life is 729 times better, more pleasant than another life? The joke seems to be based, as Socrates later mentions, on the notion that in a year, a calendar year, there are 729 days and nights total. So it seems to be an indication of the complete superiority of the philosophical life. Let me suggest something else about this joke. It opens up a theme we've explored more than once in this course, and that's the relationship between mathematics and the human soul. It is manifestly absurd to think you could calculate the superiority of a life and come up with a number as precise as 729. But what's the point of the joke? The point of the joke is similar to a point I made about the marriage number in Book 8 of the Republic. If you recall that passage, it's near the beginning of Book 8. The perfectly just city must regulate sexual reproduction. It must develop what today we would call the science of genetic engineering, or eugenics. The marriage number is a very obscure passage. We can't fathom the mathematics there. But the point is clear. The rulers fail to calculate the marriage number. In other words, they fail to arrive at a mathematically based science which would be able to control Eros. The beginning of this lecture, I suggested that Eros is shorthand for the human soul, the human psyche. The marriage number, therefore, represents the failure of mathematics to capture what is most human. We know very well that Plato was a lover of mathematics, but he did not take mathematics and place it at the absolute pinnacle of intellectual endeavors. Mathematics is good, but it's not that good. It's not as good as philosophy, and philosophy is not equivalent to mathematics. What is philosophy? Philosophy is what we find in Plato's Republic. It's conversation, it's dialectic. It's human beings talking to each other using old-fashioned, regular language, not mathematics. So unlike many modern thinkers, Plato relegates mathematics to a subordinate role, good but not the best. I think the joke that's found at 587e in Book 9 is a similar reminder of this point. It would also explain an earlier suggestion I made. The various arguments that Socrates gave us concerning the superiority of philosophical pleasure were not entirely convincing. They were not convincing, not because Socrates doesn't believe his conclusion. He does think that philosophy is the best and most pleasurable form of life. But I don't think he believes that there is a single argument, some sort of logical train of thought that in a nutshell could prove the way a mathematical equation might prove its result. The true argument for why philosophy is superior to any other form of life, particularly that of the tyrant, is given in the Republic as a whole, not restricted to just these little three arguments we reviewed earlier. It's the entire Republic in which we gain an understanding of what it means to be a human being. And I believe that is the ultimate teaching of the Republic. It's teaching us what it is to have a soul. At this point, let me mention a very famous problem that scholars have identified in the Republic. An author named David Sacks, you'll find his article in your bibliographies, made this point in an article that has been much discussed. At the end of the Republic, it's unclear whether Socrates is talking about justice in a normal way or whether he is talking about philosophical justice in the extraordinary sense that he has developed his own ideas through the course of the Republic. The title of David Sacks' article is The Fallacy of Irrelevance in Plato's Republic. And what he means by irrelevance is, at the very beginning of the Republic, the encounter with Thrasymachus and then with Glaucon that we've discussed at such length, the challenge is to demonstrate that a life of justice is superior to a life of injustice. Now, what Thrasymachus has in mind when he defends the life of injustice is, you might say, ordinary, run-of-the-mill injustice. Robbing people, being unfair, taking advantage of a political system rather than being concerned with the well-being of the whole. It therefore seems that what Socrates is required to do in order to respond adequately to Thrasymachus is defend the life of, let's call it, run-of-the-mill justice. Obeying the law, not robbing people, caring about the community in ways that we would all associate with justice as it is conventionally understood. But of course, as you now know from studying Plato's Republic, the justice that Socrates actually discusses throughout the long, long process that is this dialogue goes far beyond the run-of-the-mill, the ordinary. It seems that what he's discussing, and this has been apparent in the way I've developed my own terminology in this course, is philosophical justice. Justice at the end of Book 4 is the harmony of the soul, reason ruling desire with the assistance of spirit. Justice is philosophical harmony of the soul. It's the love of wisdom. Now, I think what some critics might say is, Socrates, you did a really great job explaining that to us, but you never really explained run-of-the-mill justice. Why is that superior? I believe you. I can imagine a critic saying that philosophy is superior to injustice, but why is conventional justice superior to justice? What this suggests is that the real concern of Plato's Republic is philosophy itself. It's actually not justice, at least not justice in the ordinary sense of the term. We have been moving, as you are surely aware, further and further away from the ordinary concerns of an ordinary city. We've been moving, to use the language of the parable of the cave, closer and closer to the sun, leaving the cave behind. I think that's a very deliberate thrust of the Republic. Plato crafts his dialogue precisely to make that point, that the truest concern for justice leads actually away from the city towards philosophy. We'll come back to that point. Let me close this section with a brief look at another extraordinary passage in Book 9. It occurs at 588 C to E. Here, what Socrates does is once again reformulate his tripartite psychology. We've had reason, spirit, and desire. We've had the wisdom lover, the gain lover, the honor lover. And now what Socrates does is construct an image, a picture, which is meant to capture this sense of the tripartite psychology. But as we'll see, it also changes it in a very significant way. What we should do is the following, says Socrates. Let's draw a picture in which a many-headed beast, known as the Hydra, represents desire. We'll have a lion represent spirit. And we'll use a human being to represent reason, the three parts. And we will then enclose all three parts in a human being. And this now is the picture of the human soul. This image, once again, is used in order to make the basic point that Socrates wishes to make, and that is that a life of justice should be pursued. Justice is when reason rules the soul. We now know that reason is the most human of those three beasts inside of a human being. And so, therefore, another way to put Socrates' point is that justice is more human than injustice. The person who would get away with doing injustice becomes more like a beast than a human being. But this is a very odd picture, and you can figure out why if you either draw it or just try to imagine it. Recall, inside a human being is a hydra, the many-headed beast, a lion, and a human being. It's that last item that makes it so peculiar, because if there's a human being inside of a human being, then presumably within that human being is a hydra, a lion, and a human being. And inside that human being, the same three appear. What this suggests is we are on an infinite loop, which is an impossible picture. This is the way some commentators describe this last picture. It's actually a non-picture. It is not a formal structure. It can't be because it infinitely expands. Now, I believe this is entirely deliberate on Plato's part to have Socrates offer this revision of the tripartite psychology. And it goes back to the same theme I've been making for much of this lecture. I mentioned that the failure of the marriage number and the joke about the life of philosophy being so precisely superior to the life of injustice that we can calculate it at 729. The import of those passages was to suggest that mathematics can't capture the human soul. I think the picture at 588C, or rather the non-picture, makes the same point. Compare it to the tripartite psychology of Book 4. Three separate parts. Reason, spirit, desire. They are static, they are rigidly structured, and as we discussed when we were discussing Book 4, it's an incoherent scheme. What made that scheme in Book 4 incoherent is that it required reason to give orders to desire, but desire is so separated from reason that it would be unable to comprehend the orders. In sum, the tripartite scheme of Book 4 is too mathematical. It's too rigid. Each of those three parts is like a separate unit, like a number. Whereas the last image that we find in Book 9, I would suggest, is much more authentically human precisely because it's not so rigid. It's in constant motion. It's in a mode of expansion. And that is much more of an accurate sense of what the human soul really is.